You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to our microlearning podcast series, Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Retinal Diseases to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes. I'm your host, Sharon Windsor-Harker, Medical Director of the Vision Relief Program at Med Learning Group. This is the last in a five-part podcast series addressing treatment burden and retinal disease. Today, we are focusing on diabetic macular edema. We're thrilled to welcome back Dr. David Eichenbaum, Collaborative Associate Professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine and Director of Research at Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida in St. Petersburg. Dr. Eichenbaum, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. I'm grateful to be back.
You've been active on the conference circuit lately. Were there any studies on DME that you found particularly interesting?
So there's promising data for new mechanisms of action in DME. We had at the American Academy of Ophthalmology a reprise of the Verona results from EyePoint's EYP-1901 program looking specifically at DME. And it looks like there's potentially an even more robust response with tyrosine kinase inhibition than to the aflibercept control group in that small study, at least for most of the patients. So that's encouraging. Between the robustness and the durability, that could be something for diabetic macular edema. Ocular Therapeutics also has their axitinib implant in development for diabetic retinopathy. And even though that drug is pursuing a pathway for DR instead of DME, we do see a reduction in retinal volume in their DR patients, implying it may have some activity in DME. And I'm further hopeful that the later stage gene therapies will potentially have a role in diabetic macular edema as drugs that create a biofactory within the eye for potent anti-angiogenic proteins. So I think these novel mechanisms of action and novel delivery systems are very promising for diabetic macular edema, looking at efficacy and reduction of treatment burden in the future. Of course, that has to be coupled with the safety that we're familiar with from drugs like aflibercept HD and faricimab, and we need to maintain the very high level of safety that we're used to while getting products that are more durable, more potent, and less burdensome for our diabetic macular edema patients.
That's so interesting. As a leader in retinal disease management, what are the biggest challenges you found when managing DME?
The toughest thing about diabetic macular edema is really having patients maintain the frequency required to have a good response to their treatment, especially in the early part of their treatment, in the first year or two. There's usually excitement at the beginning of treatment. Patients are seeing better. We see the anatomy improving, but there's treatment fatigue, and the DME population has a lot of barriers to care. They're usually younger, usually working, can have children and or parents who need them, and they often have a higher cost for care, with commercial insurance making up a large part of the third-party payer system for DME patients.
What approaches do you suggest clinicians take to overcome some of these challenges?
So the best way to mitigate these challenges is to give patients the most potent and most durable treatment that they can get as early in their treatment course as they can get it. For some patients, that means second-generation anti-angiogenics. Some patients who have challenging access pathways to those can be candidates earlier on for various corticosteroids, either unbranded or branded corticosteroids. And of course, clinical trial options are great for patients if you're a clinician with access to clinical trials. But oftentimes, clinical trials do require monthly visits, and sometimes that's a barrier for patients if they just can't make the monthly visits. I like personally heading towards the second generation biologics, the faricimab and the aflibercept 8 milligram, because they have very good safety profiles. They do have better efficacy and better durability than first generation drugs. And I try to lean on those as often as I can in my non-clinical trial patients.
Have you seen compelling real-world evidence on how to address the treatment burden associated with anti-VEGF management of DME?
So real-world patients are different from our clinical trial patients. The real-world data is different than clinical trial data. The disadvantage of real-world data is it's noisy, it's full of confounders, it's got all kinds of issues with the patients that keep them from being a well-controlled population. What it does give us is a window into how things actually work, and it gives us volume. We have tremendous volume in the real world. We've seen presentations looking at faricimab from the Tahoe grassroots trial of real-world use of faricimab in diabetic macular edema, and we do have an encouraging result from that. We have real-world data collection ongoing looking at the real-world use of faricimab in diabetic macular edema, and we need to watch these databases as they develop. We also have real-world use just emerging of the port delivery system in diabetic macular edema. We know from the clinical trial that patients seem to do well in a controlled population when the PDS is used with concentrated ranibizumab in diabetic macular edema, and that's just emerging as a commercial product. So we got to keep an eye and see if our first commercially available long-term therapy has compelling real-world data. So we have a lot to look for, and I think the data sets that will be most robust from the real world at first will be faricimab and aflibercept HD data sets.
When introducing next-generation therapies to patients already on first-generation anti-VEGF, how do you approach those conversations?
It's an important conversation to have, and I find a pretty easy conversation to have. If I'm taking a patient who's already on aflibercept and I want to increase their durability and they're doing reasonably well on aflibercept, I tell them there's a new formulation of aflibercept, which is more concentrated and usually longer lasting. So that's a short conversation. If I have a patient who I'm converting to faricimab, I tell the patient that this is a new formulation which approaches their disease in two ways instead of one way. So both of them are fairly straightforward conversations to have. I tell them that these new formulations have been well studied and we have some real world evidence and I have lots of experience in them from pre-commercial through commercial use, and they are as safe as best as we can tell as the earlier drugs while combining more potency and durability with that safety. So it's a fairly easy conversation to have. I tell the patients it's basically an upgrade, and depending on the patient and which agent you're recommending or selecting, you can tailor your upgrade conversation to the capabilities of that agent.
I see. How can you identify which patients with DME are most likely to benefit from next-generation treatments and who might not be such an ideal candidate? And how do you integrate this decision-making into your daily practice?
I think that the patients who are most likely to benefit are those who are already doing well on an existing agent or treatment-naive patients, since we looked at both in the registration trials and the clinical trials. If a patient's doing well on an earlier generation agent like ranibizumab or aflibercept 2 milligram, they're likely to do well on a second-generation agent which contains the properties of those agents but with a more potency and durability because of a higher molar dose or the addition of a second mechanism of action. The philosophy that I have that I mentioned earlier is to get the patients to the most potent and most durable treatment as early in their treatment journey as possible. So I try to integrate the agents sooner than later. And I think the patients who are not ideal candidates are those who respond poorly to antiangiogenics of any sort. And we all have these patients who don't seem to dry up on first or second generation agents. And you can identify them pretty quickly sometimes. And those are patients who are more inflammatory diabetics. And those are great candidates for corticosteroid treatment.
What would you say to a colleague who worries that patients won't respond after switching to next-generation agents and they'll have to switch back to first-generation agents, potentially losing their trust?
So that's an interesting concern, and I would tell that prescriber, that colleague who's worried specifically about that concern, is that the patient's trust is gained not through switching the medications, but in the communication with the patient regarding what's going on. I think that modification of the label in aflibercept HD that just occurred this month in November, I think we are not going to have to worry about switching back as much because of the inability to extend. And switching to faricimab as a second generation agent already has a flexible label with dosing as frequent as every 4 weeks since launch. And I think that if a patient, quote unquote, fails one of those agents after switching from an earlier generation anti-angiogenic, that might be a great patient to add in a corticosteroid, introduce an intravitreal dexamethasone implant, perhaps, or consider intravitreal triamcinolone. So it's one of those things that I don't think about much because we now have flexibility in the label of both of our second generation anti-angiogenics, and we do still have the long-standing class of corticosteroids to help patients who are the toughest to treat with regards to their diabetic macular edema.
Fantastic. Are most of your patients on next-gen agents achieving extended treatment intervals? How does that compare to treat and extend intervals with first-generation agents?
I would agree that most of my patients receiving aflibercept 8 milligram or faricimab as a treatment do go longer with treat and extend than they do with the first generation agents. Now, this is not like profoundly longer. They're not going from 6 or 8 weeks between injections to 6 or 8 months between injections. But I would say on average, and what I tell patients is on average, if they're on a treat and extend protocol and they need ongoing therapy, I can usually get them between 2 and 4 weeks longer with these newer drugs. And I think that's a reasonable thing to expect. If you can't get them 2 or 4 weeks longer, again, that's a patient who's probably fairly severe and may benefit from the addition of corticosteroids.
That's great. How comfortable are you with longer intervals between visits? And what factors influence that comfort level?
So with diabetic macular edema, I have a good level of comfort with extension for a couple of reasons. First of all, we do have really good data for these second generation agents that they go longer. That's important point number one. Important point number two is that diabetic macular edema is a fairly forgiving disease. And if the patient does recur, you can usually get the vision back and you know not to extend them out quite as aggressively. So for patients who really are eager to extend, when I start them or switch them to a second generation agent, once they're dry, I can extend them comfortably as quickly as 4 weeks between extension intervals. So they can go from Q4 to Q8 to Q12 in my practice if they really want to extend. I typically extend patients on second generation agents by 2 or 3 weeks, but they can go to 4 or 5 week extensions if you really want to get them pushed out.
Aflibercept 8 milligrams just received approval from the FDA across all its indications to add a monthly dosing interval. How will this impact your practice?
So I'm very excited that we now have more flexibility in the dosing of aflibercept HD, as well as the approval of retinal vein occlusion as a indicated disease state for treatment. It's going to allow me to treat patients who are responsive to aflibercept and aflibercept 8 milligrams a little more often if they need it. There are patients who can't get out to 8 weeks, your more severe DME or AMD patients, for example. And I think those patients are not necessarily ones you have to step back to aflibercept 2 milligrams anymore. They're patients who could continue on aflibercept 8 milligrams and be treated a little more often, maybe every 6 or 7 weeks, with confidence that you're going to get reimbursed for those costly doses.
What challenges have you found with next-generation anti-VEGF agents?
The biggest challenge that we get with these agents is access and cost to the patient. Like everything else, innovation is expensive. And when these patients with more highly managed insurance plans are suffering from disease that would potentially benefit from the most modern commercial agents we have, sometimes the patients have difficulty getting through the out-of-pocket costs for these agents. With commercial insurance, we do have the copay assistance from the manufacturers, which is great. With original Medicare and a supplement, we often have good coverage. The patients who are hit the hardest are those with Medicare Advantage plans, since currently we don't have grant funding for these patients through Good Days. And I find that these patients, unfortunately, have the unmet need of a high cost to get these agents. And some of them have truly high burden disease that these agents would help.
What kind of feedback are you hearing from your patients about their experience with next generation agents?
So most of my patients on second generation agents are generally still wanting fewer injections. They are happy when they have a reduction in their injection need. They're thrilled to be getting injections less often, and they're grateful even when you can extend them 2 weeks or 4 weeks, but they all want fewer shots. It's like a partially satisfying solution. They're certainly grateful when you can extend them out, and I tell them they can get 2 weeks and they're some of them are unusually happy about that, I think. But I think from a patient perspective, it makes a huge difference coming in for a visit every month or 10 or 12 times a year, or coming in for a visit every month and a half, which reduces you to, you know, 8 or 9 times a year. It's a big difference for the patients. Now, of course, they'd like to have something that's injected every 6 months or 12 months or once in a lifetime, and we're trying to get there. But in the meantime, I find that patients do have a lot of gratitude and some satisfaction from the reduced burden of switching to second generation agents.
What information do you think is most important to share with clinicians about the management of diabetic macular edema?
So the most important pearl I could give clinicians regarding DME is don't be satisfied with a partial response. Now, you want to try to get your patients to have a dry macula. You want them to stay dry. You don't want to have fluctuation in the macular thickness. You don't want to have a patient who only gets part of the way there. You want to really try to get your patients there. And once you get them there, you'll find that even though their acuity doesn't necessarily change a whole lot when they go from a macula that's like 370 microns to a macula that's 315 microns or something like that, the quality of the vision, I think, gets a lot better over time. And the acuity will get somewhat better over time. So really try to dry them up and try to keep them dry. I think that's the best pearl I can give folks. And don't forget, your toolbox is larger than it used to be and continues to enlarge. It's a fun time to be in retina, and it's a gratifying time to be in retina, and the best is yet to come.
Thank you so much, Dr. Eichenbaum. This was a fabulous discussion. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise.
Thank you for having me on the program, Sharon. I appreciate it as well.
Thank you again. To our listeners, we hope you found this episode valuable as you navigate the evolving landscape of retinal disease management. Please explore the previous podcasts in this series, as well as the many resources available on vision-relief.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC. To provide continuing education for the healthcare team. And a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc., who provided an independent educational grant for this activity.